So I hope everyone had a nice Purim. Immediately, as soon as Purim ends, Pesach is on the mind. The preparations for the home and for the Seder starts crossing everyone's mind. Already I cleaned out my car for Pesach 2 weeks ago. But that's because I'm actually going to Israel in 2 weeks. I'm going to be away during the main Pesach cleaning season for my nephew's bar mitzvah. So my wife already got me working early, so I can do some jobs before I leave. Anyways, so what's Purim and Pesach is on the mind. There's actually a lot of connections between Purim and Pesach. We actually had a class once about those connections. I'm not going to go into too many of those today. But Purim and Pesach connect in many ways, and this period between Purim and Pesach kind of accentuates that connection. One interesting connection or contrast between Purim and Pesach is found in the idea that many deeper commentaries explain, which is that just like in history, let's say it this way, history actually you view as an image of a human being, meaning that history begins in the head and it goes all the way down to the feet. What I mean by that, we refer to the generation of Jews that left Egypt as the Dor Dea, the generation of knowledge, refers to the mind, the head. We refer to the generation that will greet the Mashiach in the later generations as Ikvasa de Mashiach, the heels of Mashiach, which means that history is kind of transitioning from the head down to the feet. And every generation should find their place somehow corresponding to the human body. It'd be an interesting exercise to take each generation and figure out which part of the human body they correspond to. We view the generation that left Egypt as the generation of the mind, the Dor Dea, the generation of knowledge, and the final generations refer to the heels. And everything in between kind of, will slowly, gradually go down the human body, getting to the feet. That's how we view all of history. Similarly, we view the year that way. The year begins with the month of Nisan, Pesach. According to the Torah, the first month is Nisan. Again, it's a misunderstanding we all have. We think that Tishrei is the first month where Rosh Hashanah begins. The truth is Rosh Hashanah begins the year, but months begin in Nisan. When the Torah says the first month, that means Nisan, does not mean Tishrei. When we count that the year is 5774, we're counting from Rosh Hashanah. So there's two different counts going on. But the months of the year begin with Nisan, which is the head of all the months. And that's what it says, Rosh Chadashim, literally the head of the month. It's the head. That's what the Torah says. That the very first mitzvah the Jews got in Egypt was that they should make Nisan into their first month, and God calls it the head of all months. We looked at Purim then. Purim is the last month. The month we're in right now, called Adar, is the very last month of the year. This is the 12th month this year. It's like the 13th month this year because it was a leap year. And Adar refers to the month of the heels. Like we said, just like the generations go from the head to the heels, the months every single year go from the head to the heels. Nisan's the head, and Adar is the heels. When we talk about that, there's a major difference between the head and the heels. The head is where the brain is. The head is what guides the entire body. The head's the place of thought. The head we look at as the seat of the soul is in the head, in the human body. The head is the place where really the human functions. The heels are the least sensitive part of the body. Your foot, a person's foot is calloused. You could take a needle and stick it in, you don't even feel it. You walk around, you with your shoes off, and your foot can tolerate a lot. There's very little feeling there. There's no thought in the foot. It's the most distant part from the head. And that's how we view the foot. So, in other words, we would say that the Jews, when they are functioning as the Dor Dea, as the generation of knowledge, or functioning in the month of Nisan at Pesach, we're focusing on our head, on our minds. On Purim, in terms of the year, and in the final generations of history, in terms of the historical progression of the Jewish people, so we're looking at the feet, which are numb, which are insensitive. But the goal of the feet, what do we do with our feet on Purim? We dance. Purim is the day where your feet wake up, your feet start dancing, and the emotions are able to hit even the least sensitive parts of the body. Even those parts of the body which are most numb, which are most distant from the thoughts and the mind, those parts of the body on Purim start waking up, and they start dancing. That's a view on Purim. And it's the idea, it's the emotion in a person. We look at emotion as coming in the heart, and dance is the greatest expression of emotion. The intellect's in the head, that's the mind. So Purim we really view as a day of emotion. It's a day of joy, it's a day of gladness, and that corresponds to the feet dancing, and the feet kind of becoming excited and exuberant, enthusiastic. Pesach is a time to focus on the mind. Pesach is a time of the intellect. It's where we're dealing with the Seder is a time where we discuss, and we have intellectual understandings. It's a day of information. Purim is a day which is kind of crazy and chaotic and wild, as we all know. Because it's not a day of the mind, it's a day of the emotion. The Pesach is a very it's very much orderly. It's methodical. You have to clean methodically. The Seder itself, Seder means order. The Seder is a method. The Seder is a progression. That's what the Seder is. Because it's, when the mind is in control, things are very orderly. Things are very methodical. Purim is not methodical orderly. Purim is more wild and crazy. That's because Purim corresponds to the feet. And when the feet start dancing, that's the emotions coming out as you look at Purim. It's very interesting, which I'm not going to right now. The concept of people drinking on Purim, the way that the rabbis describe it, this person should drink until the point where they do not know the difference between cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai. Without going into what that means, you should know that it's until you reach a point where you don't understand, right? Until you do not know. Adilo yada, until you do not know the difference. Meaning, Pesach is about knowing. Purim is getting to a point where you're not using knowledge, you're using emotion. You're not using intellect, you're using the feeling. So Purim, you're going beyond knowledge, beyond the intellect, beyond just the typical thought process and the methodology of thought, and you're trying to tap into something deeper with that, which is emotion, which is desire, that's passion, that's Purim is about. But Pesach, we're going to focus more on the thoughts and the ideas. Now, in terms of reaching out to Hashem, becoming closer to God, growing spiritually, there's two different ways you can go about doing that. Sometimes you need the intellect to impact the emotions. Sometimes the emotions can impact the intellect. Meaning they're both necessary. You need to have both your mind and your heart involved in serving God. And that's really one of the tenets of Judaism. We need our minds. We have Torah study is focusing on the mind. You need your hearts. You need to make sure that you feel it as well. Sometimes the feeling, the joy, the emotion can impact how you think. Purim is there, you're focusing on the emotion. And the emotions, the feelings of joy and of unity and of gladness and of faith in God, which comes on Purim, which is, again, it's emotions. Purim's not a day of intellect, it's a day of the emotion. But that eventually should feed into the mind, understanding things differently. And the mind, the intellect, kind of being able to analyze and understand the world in a different way. Pesach is where we're focusing on the mind, and we're speaking, we're discussing, we're analyzing the stories of the Torah, the stories of the Exodus. And the mind on Pesach then should impact the emotion, and we should leave Pesach with a feeling of emotional love and joy for God. This comes from two different angles. Sometimes the emotions impact the mind, sometimes the minds impact the emotions. And we know both experiences, we've probably experienced it both ways, different times in our lives, and they're both true. So Purim and Pesach kind of work hand in hand in that way. One's the emotion, one's a focus on the emotion, one's a focus on the mind, and together that creates the full picture. Pesach is the source, really, as we mentioned many times in the past few months, the source of our emunah, the source of our faith in God, everything we need to know about God is found in the Pesach story. It talks about the foundations of Jewish life, of Jewish people, and of the Torah. It's all about emunah. It's all about faith in God. We discussed how the spectacle of the God created in Egypt, that was supposed to be the information that we need for history to understand God. That's what it's all about. The Seder is the primary time on Pesach where we share and we discuss and we explore the foundation of Judaism. That's the role of the Seder in Jewish life. The Seder should be, and hopefully is, one of the most powerful experiences a Jew should have throughout the year in terms of connecting with our faith, with our history, with emunah, with faith in God. And it's the focus on what happened in Egypt is the main focus, but it goes far beyond that. The Torah tells us several times that why did God do so many miracles in Egypt? And again, I mentioned this over and over again, I mentioned it one more time. It says, L'man Yedu, so that we should know who God is, or L'man Tesaper, so that we should tell other generations, tell our children, tell each other. We should pass on for history everything we saw in Egypt, because that is the primary example, that's the paradigm God created of understanding how he runs the world, how he acts, how he intervenes, his power. That's what the Exodus is all about. And we saw that in the Exodus, that became our model for history. So Pesach is so important, and particularly the Seder is so important, because we're passing on what it means to be a Jew, the fundamentals of Judaism. The Seder simply is, the word Seder we said means order. And simply, the Seder is a procedure by which we fulfill our mitzvahs we have of the night of Pesach. We have five, nowadays, we have five mitzvahs we do the night of Pesach, on the Seder. Those five mitzvahs, some are rabbinic and some are biblical in origin. But the five mitzvahs, which we'll just review, are eating matzah, eating the maror, the bitter herbs, telling the story of the Exodus, reciting the Hallel, and drinking 4 cups of wine. Those are our 5 mitzvahs of Seder night. Again, some of those are rabbinic, some of those are biblical, but those are our 5 mitzvahs based on that. One more time. Eating matzah, eating the maror, telling the story of the Exodus, saying the Hallel, and drinking 4 cups of wine. Those are our mitzvahs. So when you have 5 mitzvahs to do, so we don't just do them, there's a procedure of how to do it. So the rabbis gave us an order. The Seder literally means order. The Seder has 15 steps. Commentaries point out the 15 steps correspond to one of the names of God, Yud Hey, which is the numerical value of 15. There are 15 steps leading up to the temple because it's a way to ascend to God. It's these 15 steps. That's how we view it. In Tehillim and Psalms, we have 15 Shir Hamalos, 15 Psalms that begin Shir Hamalos, which correspond to these 15 steps of entering into the temple, to temple grounds, which are the same as the 15 steps of the Seder. It all goes together. That's the power of the number 15. So these have to be done in the proper procedure. In these 15 steps, that's the Kadesh, Urchatz, Karpas, Yachatz, all those steps they sing in the song. And that's what we do at Seder night. The main focus of the night, though, even though we have all these mitzvahs to do, I mean, a bulk of the time usually is and should be spent upon telling the story of the Exodus. It's a mitzvah referred to as Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, relating the story of the Exodus. That's a biblical command which applies to us even nowadays, to every single Jew, man, woman, and child above bar mitzvah age. And that mitzvah is really the centerpiece of the night. No matzah is involved, maror is involved, it's all involved, but the centerpiece of the night really is the mitzvah to tell the story. And that's what I want to focus on. Hopefully this week, the next few weeks, we'll focus on some different parts of the Haggadah, which because the purpose of the Haggadah, the word Haggadah means to tell. Haggadah, lehagid, is to tell. Because the Haggadah is the book which gives us the outline of how to tell the story. That's what Haggadah is all about. So we're going to focus on understanding the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, of retelling the story of the Exodus. Yeah.
But what are the other 5 mitzvahs?
Matzah is biblical. Nowadays, the other three are all rabbinic. The eating maror is biblical only if you're eating the Karban Pesach along with the sacrifice. We don't have that. Since we don't have that, the maror became rabbinic. If we had the actual Karban Pesach, the Pesach sacrifice, that would be an additional biblical command to do on the Seder, and then the maror would actually become biblical as well. Because we don't have that, the maror is now devoted to rabbinic command. We're saying Hallel is rabbinic, and the 4 cups are rabbinic. The matzah is still a biblical command, and so is telling the story of the Exodus, also biblical.
The Seder is a way to incorporate all. If you go through the Seder, you'll incorporate all 4 of these.
All 5, yeah.
All 5.
And the truth is, like, for instance, the 4 cups of wine have to be done in this order. The Gemara tells us that if you were just to take 4 cups, 1, 2, 3, 4, you don't do your mitzvah. You have to make sure those 4 cups are done in the proper order. So the first cup we have with Kiddush. The second cup we have after we've told the story, right before the meal. The third cup we have after we bench, after we say the bracha after the meal. And the fourth cup we have with Hallel, but it's done in that order. If you just want to have, you know, 4 cups of wine straight, you haven't done your mitzvah. That only counts as one. So that's how important the order actually is, to go in that order. The goal of telling the story of the Exodus is not just story time. I mean, all of us know the story. We've heard the story many, many times. It's a story which even, you know, the most assimilated Jew is familiar with. It's not about the story. But the story is supposed to be a springboard to something much greater. The goal is really to build ourselves up to the point, as the rabbis tell us, that everyone has to view themselves as if they left Egypt. The whole door of Ador, every generation, we have a responsibility to see ourselves as if we personally left Egypt. We have to feel it. It's supposed to impact us. We're starting with intellect, we're starting with discussions, starting with stories, we're starting with analyzing the stories of the Torah and the Haggadah. We're supposed to end up with a feeling of gratitude as if we stepped out of slavery. We're supposed to feel the impact that that story had on our lives. We feel that we have been slaves, we are all enslaved in our lives in different ways, and God frees us. God helps us out. And that's something which we should finish the Seder with, very deep feelings of gratitude to Hashem for our own lives, for our portion of being Jews, for our privilege of being Jews. And we should see ourselves as if we feel that we have been enslaved and we have left Egypt. Now that's taken on many different levels. I mean, one very simple level is that had we not been free, we may have still been there. On a deeper level, it applies to our nation. Our nation was a nation of slaves, and now we're a nation of free people, free to serve God. And different Hasidic sources take it in a much deeper way. They say that everybody encounters their own types of slavery. The word for Egypt in Hebrew, Mitzrayim, comes from the root Mitzar, which means to be limited. We all have our own personal limits, and we have to pray to God to free us from our personal limits. Everyone feels limited in their own ways. We have our own personal struggles. We have our own personal Mitzrayim. We have our own personal Egypt. And our goal always is to pray to God that God should save us. God should pull us out and free us from our own personal Egypt, our own personal Mitzrayim, and bring us to freedom. And Pesach is a time where we are able to tap in not only to the ancient slavery of the Jews, not only to our history, but also to our current slavery. We as a people, we're still limited. We as individuals are limited. And we pray that God frees us. But when the Seder ends, we should feel this feeling of gratitude that God is our Savior. God is the one who frees us and emancipates us from all of our struggles and all of our limits, all of our slavery. And we should end the Seder with a real feeling of love and gratitude to God for what He's done for us and what He continues to do for us. There is a very old custom after the Seder. Most of us are probably too tired at that point to do this. Many people do read the book of Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, following the Seder. A lot of Haggadahs have it. I don't know if this one has it. Maxwell House may not put it in, but a lot of Haggadahs have it at the end, after the Seder, after Chag Gadiah. They'll have the book of the Song of Songs printed in the Haggadah, because they don't have it in Maxwell House. I guess they don't have that custom. But many Jews recite that book of the Torah. Why is that? Because the Song of Songs is essentially a love song written between, in the literal level, between a man and a woman. And it's a metaphor for the Jewish people and God. And when you end the Seder, you should feel such a love for God, such a gratitude to God, that you should just want to belt out a love song to God. That's how you should feel. So there's a very old custom to recite Shir HaShirim, a Song of Songs, after the Seder. But whether you recite that's the Song of Songs or not, the point is that we should feel those emotions. The emotion after the Seder shouldn't be, I'm so tired I won't hit my bed. And it shouldn't be that's too much matzah. It should be that I have such a gratitude and love for God. It's such an inspiring night. I feel so uplifted. I feel so spiritually connected now. That should be the feeling. And then you go to sleep and you wake up in the morning and you feel different in the morning. When you go to shul next morning, you should feel an extra special surge of love for God at that point, because you've reflected upon all of God's kindness and miracles that God performed for us both in Egypt and throughout history. That's what we do. The Haggadah is meant to serve essentially as an outline. And I think a lot of us fall into the trap of we get lost reading the text and we miss the message. And we all do it. And the text of the Haggadah, I'll tell you, it's a difficult text. And I don't just mean translating the Hebrew. I mean, you read through the English, just a lot of it doesn't seem to flow. It's not the way we would tell a story. It doesn't start, you know, once upon a time in a far-off land, there was this nation, and then happily ever after. We don't have that in this story. It's different points. It quotes different verses from the Torah. It expounds upon them. It's not always in order. So it's a difficult work, and that's something which takes, you have to take time to prepare the Haggadah. You have to look at commentaries, think about it, and understand that there's something here more than a story. There's a message. There's supposed to be fundamentals of Judaism that are being portrayed in every single paragraph of the Haggadah. We have to be trained to pull them out. As usual, the rabbis, the sages, they always write things kind of encoded in a way, because when you encode something, it's much deeper. If it was just written as a story, you know, point one, point two, point three, then that'd be it. We wouldn't see anything deeper. But when the rabbis are able to write something which is a little more complex, they can kind of encode into the text deeper messages. So the goal of, we can't begin the Haggadah when we sit down in our Seder. We have to do a little preparation beforehand in order to pull the meaning out of it. So we shouldn't fall into the trap of just reading through the text and letting that suffice. We should understand what the message is. And that takes preparation. I believe the Haggadah was made to be an outline, not to be the focus of the Seder. You're supposed to say, the rabbi has said, these are the different points to be discussed at the Seder. And this is our outline. But use the Haggadah as an outline. Use it as a springboard for other discussions, other fundamentals. And everyone has their own ways of doing it. Everyone's families, everyone's different traditions, everyone's different ways in which they are to bring out the messages. And, you know, it's interesting. I find that the Pesach Seder is probably one of the few observances we have that really, you know, our experiences are very limited. Because most people, they have them with their families. They grow up and they're having it a certain way. They continue in that way they're used to. But you don't, I mean, at least I haven't gone through too many other Seders in my life besides, you know, my parents, my in-laws, and my own. And that's what I've done. Maybe once or twice I've gone other places. But I think a lot of people have those experiences where they have, you know, a very limited scope of Seders they've seen. And which is fine, because everyone has their own ways they like to do it, which is totally okay. But everyone should be able to pull out that message and pull out the meaning from the Haggadah no matter how you do your Seder. And some Seders you find are a little bit more lively, some are a little bit more intellectual, some go longer, some go shorter. Some are more kid-focused, some are more adult-focused. I mean, there's so many kinds of seders out there. But regardless of how your seder is, we shouldn't just read through the text and think we've done our job. We should really try to pull out meaning, pull out messages. So different ways to do it. Some people like to focus on one theme per year. I've heard that method discussed. I've tried it before. Sometimes you could say, even the Haggadah gives us lots of different information, but you know, you could try to, there's a lot of themes which run throughout the entire Haggadah. And depending on what's on your mind, or who's at your Seder, or what mood you're in, you can say, this year I'm going to focus on a certain theme. This year I want to focus on reward and punishment. Or this year I want to focus on Hashgacha, divine providence. This year I want to focus on the meaning of freedom. This year I want to focus on Emunah. I mean, you can figure, what's the theme that you want to get across at your Seder this year? And you can focus on that. And you can find a lot of places in the Haggadah which seem to tie into many different themes which are out there. That's one approach I've seen. Others have a more broad approach and try to hit everything, which is also okay, and try to really pull out the message from each paragraph, which is also fine. There are different ways you can do it. Either way, no matter how you do it, the story is supposed to be a basis of what we discuss and outline, and we should take it further. We should try to pull it, make it deeper, make it more meaningful. More interactive, and you know, and not just read the text, but to pull out messages, pull out lessons. Because it's supposed to teach us the fundamentals of Judaism, it's supposed to pass on to other people, to other generations, emunah, and faith in God, and trust in God. That's what the Seder is supposed to do. There's another theme throughout the Haggadah, which is the theme of questions. We're all aware of the four questions, Manishtana. The way the Torah itself introduces the mitzvah of the Haggadah, it talks about in the form of a question, Ki Shalcha Bincha, when your son asks you the following question, you should respond to them on that day. And the Haggadah is about questions. We talk about the way it's been phrased many times in the Haggadah. You have, let's read the quote, it says, Pesach Zu Shana Ochlim Hashum Ma. Pesach Shana Yavasina Ochlim. The Pesach, the Paschal Lamb, which our ancestors ate in the times of the Temple, Al Shum Ma. Why did they eat it? And then it gives an answer. Now, God is worded in question and answer form. It could have just told us a statement. We eat matzah because of X, Y, and Z. But the way it words it, why do we eat this matzah? Because the Dover ancestors did not have time to become leavened. So the Haggadah words things in question form. Children ask the four questions. The Torah words in question form. Because questions are very important. The Maharal explains, why is it that questions are so important on Pesach? Because when a person asks a question, that means they're ready for the answer. If someone just hammers you with information, so you're not always ready to hear the information. You haven't created a place within your mind or in your heart to receive the information. When you ask a question, it means you're curious. When you're curious, you're ready to listen to the answer. So the image of the Haggadah, the setup of the Haggadah, the procedure of the Haggadah involves question and answer form. Because questions and answers are help to get us involved. Allow us to receive the answer. Allow us to have a place within our souls and our minds to take in the answer. And we should certainly, at our Seders, encourage questions, encourage discussion, encourage people asking. And it's very important because that creates a platform that people can really pull out the message of the Haggadah, to take in the answers, and to be able to have a give and take in terms of the ideas. So that's, I think, a very important part which you find built into the Haggadah, and that's something that we can really implement in our own Seders. Another point, in terms of the introduction to the Haggadah, is that a lot of the mitzvahs, we do a lot of active mitzvahs here as well. We said there's another three mitzvahs we do which are very active, eating matzah, eating mar, and drinking the four cups of wine. The concept of reclining as we eat and drink is part of the Pesach Seder. And that's because it's not just a discussion, it's an experience. We're supposed to experience the Haggadah. So we shouldn't just look at it as a time for discussion. It's a full body experience, that's what it is. The understanding of that's very simple because when you we say that your talk is cheap, when you live through something it's much more meaningful. So rather than just talking about the Jews eating matzah, you eat the matzah. And in that matzah, that's the bread of freedom, we should taste the freedom of the matzah. That's what we should taste. Instead of just talking about bitter slavery, we eat marrow, we eat the bitter herbs, and we taste the bitterness. Instead of just discussing how now God has chosen us and we've become noble and royal, we drink four cups of wine, we recline like royalty, because we're experiencing it. We're not just discussing it, we're experiencing it. We're trying to taste it, taste the slavery, taste the freedom. I always thought it was very interesting. The rabbis say that the matzah is referred to in the Torah as lechem oni, which typically is translated as the bread of affliction, or poor man's bread. But the rabbis also say you can understand oni as the lechem, the bread, which we are oneh, which we respond, we speak over this bread. I mean, you're supposed to have the matzah uncovered on the table during the Seder. And as you discuss the sort of the existence, the matzah is sitting there as kind of your conversation piece. Sitting there on the table, it's supposed to be a focal point, a centerpiece of the Seder. So the matzah sits there throughout the entire discussion. Now I like to picture this as the matzah is kind of absorbing all the words. And then you take the matzah and you eat it. You've ingested all the words you've said. You kind of take into yourself. It's this image of a person being impacted by everything they talked about that night. So you're ingesting your words. Because the matzah absorbed it all sitting there. I once heard the matzah described, look at the matzah as an envelope. The matzah is flour and water. But it's an envelope of so much more. It's an envelope containing concepts of freedom, of emunah, of faith in God, of divine providence. It's all really the matzah stuffed in there with all sorts of spiritual things. And we eat the matzah, you're not just eating flour and water, you're eating something much more. You're eating something extremely inspirational and holy and uplifting, which you're ingesting within your system. And you are what you eat. That's what we know. You are what you eat. So you eat the bread of freedom, so you feel freedom. You eat the mar, eat the bitterness, and you feel the bitterness. And it pumps through your blood at that point. That's how we should view the Seder. But look at the matzah or the maror as an envelope containing much more than what you see in front of your eyes. That's how we should view it. So what I'd like to do now is maybe open up the Haggadah, and we'll start going through a little bit of the Haggadah piece by piece, try to pull out some messages. The meaning of the Haggadah is endless. I believe it's the most written about thing, besides the actual Torah itself, I think it's the most discussed, has most commentaries on the Haggadah than any other Jewish work. You walk into any Jewish bookstore and you find dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of books on the Haggadah, both in Hebrew and English and other languages as well, because there's so much here. And it's such an important night. It's such an important night. There's so much to discuss. It never ends. So we'll try to draw out a few different points and whatever time we have. But at least it'll get us into the mode, some ideas to think about for the Seder. And again, it's something everybody needs to take their own time. No, beyond the cleaning and the cooking and the purchasing and everything else that goes into the Pesach preparation. I hate to add something else into our schedule, but to prepare the Haggadah is an extremely important part because all the preparation is getting you ready for your Seder. That's the first thing you do in Pesach. You sit down and you have your Seder the very first night of Pesach, and we have to be prepared because it's a shame to have a Seder which is dull and not inspirational after you've worked so hard getting ready for it. You know, you spend weeks and weeks and weeks, and you know, you're tired and you're sore from all your preparations, but you should at least sit down and have an inspirational Seder after the fact, because it's very important to prepare. So I'd like to start here. We're going to skip over to the beginning of Magid. Just in terms of the steps of the Seder, just as a review, so you begin with Kadesh, that's St. Kiddush, or Chatz, you wash your hands, without the blessing, Karpas, we eat the vegetable, dip in salt water, Yachatz, you break the middle matzah. Those are the first four steps. Usually go pretty fast. The fifth step is Magid, and this is where you're going to spend most of your time during the Seder, is Magid. So that begins on page 8 in the Maxwell House Haggadahs. Magid comes from, that's where the word Haggadah comes from, Magid. That's where it comes from. So really the whole Haggadah is called Haggadah because of Magid, and that means to tell. Because this is the part of the Haggadah where you're going to do your biblical mitzvah of retelling the story of the Exodus on the night of Pesach. Magid begins. I'm going to go quickly through the first two paragraphs. I want to speak more about the next page, but let's go through in order. Magid begins with Halach Ma'anya, which is, in English, says it's the bread of the affliction. This is where we lift up the matzah. And the first thing we do in Magid is we point out the matzah. And this is, as I said, the matzah becomes our centerpiece, our conversation piece of our Seder. And before we do anything else, before we mention anything about the Exodus, we open up the matzah and say, this is the matzah. This is what the Jews ate in Egypt. This is what the Jews ate when they left Egypt. This is the focus of our night. And this is what's going to absorb everything discussed as the night carries on. We invited others to our Seder at that point, which other commentaries point out it's a little bit too late to invite guests. It's interesting. Some say simply at the Seder, you're supposed to be acting like royalty. So to say, my door is open, anyone wants to come in, come in. That's a royal expression. That I'm wealthy, I'm well-to-do, and whoever wants to come join me can join me. It's kind of a procedure being done. But that is a question which people discuss, which I'm not going to get into right now, but why is it that we're inviting guests to our Seder only on, you know, when the Seder has begun, we're on page 8, we're only inviting in our guests. It's an interesting thing. We also point out in this paragraph that this year, we're still enslaved because we're in exile, we're not yet redeemed, we're not yet in Israel, not in Jerusalem. But we dive in already at the beginning of the Seder that we should be next year be in Jerusalem, which the Seder ends that as well. Because as much as we discuss being freed, as much as we discuss the fact that the Exodus has created for us the opportunity to act as free people and be God's people, if we are in exile, we're still in Golos, we don't have the temple rebuilt, we can't say that we are totally free. We're still subjugated to other nations at this point. And we daven at this point that this year we're servants here. Next year we hope to be free men in the land of Israel. That's what we say. We immediately begin at this point the four questions. The four questions, Ma'ishtana halayla hazem yikol leilos. And this is, as I said, the Haggadah is based on a question and answer form. So the very beginning of the story is first the questions come in. Now, as we know, the custom is the children ask these questions. The truth is, the rabbis tell us that this is not special for children, that if there's no children's theater, adults ask the questions. Questions should be asked. Because, really, questions and answers are what the seder is all about. So even though the custom is the children ask the questions, it's not limited to children. And if you're, even if it was two adults sitting there at a seder together, they would ask these questions as well, because the seder is supposed to begin the question and answer. Now, what's interesting is that the Gemara says that really, you don't need to ask these questions. The point is to start with a question. These questions are the ones are the script, because if the kid doesn't ask, you want to give them a script to say. But really, if you can engage others asking questions besides Manishtana, technically you don't need to say Manishtana. Now, of course, we all say Manishtana. It's the classic custom of the Jewish people say Manishtana. But technically, if you begin the Seder, people are already asking questions. Manishtana isn't necessary, according to the Talmud, because Manishtana is just supposed to be the backup script in case no one asks a question. The best thing is to encourage questions. The best thing is to be able to bring out questions. It used to be that the kids did not, when they listened to Gemara's times, they didn't go to school and they were educated with the Seder beforehand. So they'd walk in the Seder night and everything looked really strange to them. They weren't expecting it, and they started asking questions off the spot. Now they've already been prepped in school that everything's going to happen, so they're not asking any questions. They know better than we do why it's happening. So that's what happens. But a lot of the procedures we have in the Seder, such as eating the karpas, such as, there's custom moving around the Seder plate to different places. That was all to encourage kids to say, what's going on here? You're supposed to say, great question. Let me tell you about the story of the Exodus. Since sometimes kids don't ask the question, so we have a script to say. And then we give them a script of a question. We give them the script. But these are the four. I'm not going to go over the four questions right now. But the concept of question and answer, I think, is really an essential part of the Seder. What I do want to discuss more in depth is on page 10 and 11 here. Let's look at the very first paragraph. So this is immediately after Manishtana. Questions have been raised. Why is this night so different? Why are we eating matzah? Why are we eating bitter herbs? Why are we reclining? Why are we dipping? Everything's so strange tonight. So we give an answer. And Haggadah gives an answer. Let's just read. We'll read the Maxwell House English. I'm not going to vouch for the accuracy of the translation, but we'll trust Maxwell House that it's somewhat accurate. And it says, "We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and our God brought us out with a mighty hand and outstretched arm." So that's simply the answer to the question. At that point, essentially, we've answered the question of the night. Why are we doing all these strange things? Because we're slaves to Pharaoh, and God brought us out with a mighty hand and outstretched arm. And then it says, even if the Holy Blessed One had not brought our ancestors out of Egypt, we and our children and our children's children would still be in slavery to the pharaohs of Egypt. So it's an interesting point. We would still, had God not brought us out of Egypt, we would still be slaves. Now commentaries point out, well, that's not necessarily true. There's plenty of slaves in history who weren't freed by God, and were freed for other reasons. We know about the American Civil War, and slaves were freed. And we don't view that as, God is coming in. I mean, everything we view is God's intervention. But we don't see that God came in miraculously and freed the American slaves. That was a natural course of events in history. And there have been many nations throughout history who have been enslaved and been freed. So what is this assertion that had God not come in to free us, we'd still be slaves in Egypt? So again, many answers to all these questions. But one answer is given by a book. It's called Sifsei Chaim by Rabbi Chaim Friedlander, who is a great Jewish thinker who lived in Israel, died, I think, approximately 20, 30 years ago. And he writes that, let's say God did not come in to free us. So then maybe we would have been freed. We would have been freed by somebody else. Maybe Pharaoh would have let us go at some point or the other. Maybe another nation would have come in and freed us. The problem is, at that point, we feel some sense of gratitude to whoever our Savior was. So let's assume it would have been Pharaoh. Let's just say at some point Pharaoh cracks and say, okay, I've turned against slavery. I feel it's immoral. Jews, you can go. So we would have a tremendous debt of gratitude towards Pharaoh for freeing us. And even though we might hold him in a little bit of, we'd be angry with him for all those centuries of slavery, we'd still feel a little bit happy that he freed us. At that point, when you feel gratitude towards somebody, so you're always subjugated to them in some way. Even though we're not physically going to be slaves of Pharaoh, but if we respect Pharaoh and we feel gratitude towards him, So it's inevitable that we're going to have some sort of connection with him. We're going to feel subordinate to him in some way. And if Pharaoh ever wants a favor out of us, we'd say, sure, no problem, Pharaoh. Thanks for freeing us. Thanks for giving us our freedom. So Rabbi Friedlander writes that if you feel this sense of gratitude, or you see some redeeming quality in Pharaoh, because look, he turned, he became better, so that allows him to have an influence on us still. And if Pharaoh has an influence on us, so we may not be physical slaves to Pharaoh, but we're spiritually enslaved to Pharaoh, because he can influence us in some way. And what he stands for, his morals, his beliefs, will somewhat impact us. When God came in and freed us, and Pharaoh had no part in that, so we couldn't care less what Pharaoh says. We're not influenced by him anymore. It's a total break from Pharaoh, a total break from Egyptian ideology, a total break from this pagan world that we were living in. And we have no strings attached at this point. If Pharaoh freed us, there's still strings attached. Whenever anyone does you a favor, you know there's strings attached. You know? And even if they say no strings attached, there's still a string attached. And even if you don't want there to be a string attached, you still feel indebted towards them. That's how you feel. So we don't want to feel indebted to anybody else. So God is teaching us that you should know that God freed us alone. Pharaoh wasn't involved at all. Because if he was involved in any way, shape, or form, even if he became free, but Pharaoh was involved, then you're still a slave to Pharaoh. Because there's a string attached. You're influenced by him. He's able to come and he's able to persuade you. He's able to influence you in some way. The Exodus for Egypt was supposed to be a transition from the Jews being servants of Pharaoh to servants of God. It's supposed to be a clean cut, a clear transition. It's interesting, the whole concept of slavery. A lot of commentaries ask, well, why did God feel necessary that Jews become enslaved in the first place? If God told Abraham centuries beforehand that your children are going to be slaves in a far-off land and be persecuted and be tormented, why was it necessary in the development of the Jewish people? So many explain, because to become a servant of God, you have to know what servitude is. And if you weren't servants beforehand, if you were free and then said, okay, now be a servant to God, you wouldn't know what it means to be a servant. But when you're enslaved for 210 years, in terrible conditions in Egypt, you know what it means to be a slave and to be a servant. Now when all you do is adjust who the master is. The master is no longer fair, the master is now God, but you already know how to be a slave. And ultimately a Jew is a servant of God. The great Moshe, one of his greatest honors, he says, and we say in the prayers on Shabbos, Shabbos morning is Shemesre, we say, Yitzvach Moshe Manaschalko, Moshe rejoiced in his portion, Ki even neman krosel, because you, God, called him a faithful servant. Moshe took the greatest joy in being a faithful servant of God. Even neman eved, just like the Jews were evadim, he was an eved in Egypt, so he was an eved of God. And that was Moshe's greatest joy. We have to learn what it means to be an eved. You have to learn what it means to serve somebody. So our time in Egypt taught us what it means to serve. And now we're supposed to transition. We're no longer servants of Pharaoh in any way, shape, or form. There's a clear cut. We're free from Pharaoh. But immediately we become servants of God. The Hallel begins with the words Hallel of Hashem. Those who are servants of Hashem should praise God. It's all about being servants of Hashem, and that's the transition. So Rabbi Friedlander writes, this explains another mysterious part of the Torah you find in the story of the Exodus. If you read the story of the Exodus, the Moshe goes to the Pharaoh to request the freedom. What does he request? So the let my people go is not so accurate. Because what he requests is, give us 3 days to serve God in the wilderness. He doesn't request free us totally. It's very strange. What was his goal? He wanted us to be free totally, obviously. God said, I'm going to free the Jewish people. But Moshe always requests to Pharaoh, give me 3 days. I just want 3 days. That's all I want. What's the idea? So where Friedlander writes, because at the end of the story, Pharaoh never, ever, ever freed the Jews. We weren't freed by Pharaoh. We were released for 3 days. Because it had to be that Pharaoh doesn't free us. God frees us. That's what it has to be. So if Moshe requested freedom and Pharaoh said, you're now free, so we'd still feel some inkling of gratitude towards Pharaoh. And we don't want that. Yeah. That's still for 3 days. Because what happened after that, the Jews went towards the sea and he chased after them. He said, you didn't come back. You're supposed to come back in 3 days and you didn't come back yet. That's what Rashi explains. I'm expecting you back in 3 days. Where are you? So at that point he chased them, that's when they were killed in the sea. There's another strange thing as well. Now God tells Moshe, go tell the Jewish people to go and borrow vessels from all the Egyptians. Go knock on the doors, you know, borrow their pots and pans, borrow their vessels, go borrow all their utensils. Now there's no intent of repaying this loan. This was supposed to be, you're taking your stuff and you're getting out of here. Why did God say you should borrow their items? Because again, if the Egyptians gave us their possessions, we'd feel somehow indebted towards the Egyptians. if they only loaned us their possessions, so we don't feel dead towards them in the same way, it's a loan. I'm supposed to give back to them. They didn't give us anything. The point is that after everything is said and done, Pharaoh never freed us, the Egyptians never gave us anything, and it was totally God breaking those chains and setting us free. So at that point, the gratitude is only towards God. There's no feeling of debt or gratitude towards the Egyptians. And we're totally, totally freed of any Egyptian influence. Because as soon as you feel a debt of gratitude towards anybody, you feel influenced by them. You know, so like we said, there's no free lunches. And you know, whenever there's a favor, there's some string attached. But even if it's not meant to be and it's subtle, there's some connection you feel. So that's what Rabbi Friedlander writes. And that's the meaning of, if he didn't take us out of Egypt, we'd still be slaves there. Not that we'd physically be building pyramids in Egypt, but we'd be somehow indebted towards them, and therefore influenced by them. It also shows another point, that God took us out and Pharaoh had no involvement. It also shows us that God needs no help from anybody. Part of the idea of the Seder is to show that God is the absolute power in this world. And if Pharaoh had to say, okay, Jews, you are now free, it's as if God needs him to say that. But bottom line, Pharaoh never said that. Because God's trying to show us that he needs no help from any human being. He does it all himself. And let's just finish this paragraph and we'll conclude with this. Now, God, as we continue, we're still back in the top paragraph. Therefore, even if we were all wise, knowledgeable, and sagacious, let's say that word. Sagacious. And learned in the law. And nevertheless, it would be incumbent upon us to tell the departure from Egypt, and all those who expand the telling of the story are counted praiseworthy. So now the Haggadah continues, even if we were all wise, we were Torah scholars, we knew the Torah backwards and forwards, the story backwards and forwards, with all the Midrashim, with all the commentaries, and everything. We still have an obligation to tell the story every single year. An obligation never ceases. And the more you talk about it, the better. That's what it tells us. So what's the message there? I think the message is that we're not talking about information here. We're talking about trying to influence our own personal feelings and beliefs in God. The information is only supposed to be means to an end. So you might know all the information, but the more you discuss it and think about it, analyze it, chew it over, relate it to your own life, then it becomes more real and it affects us more, influences us more. Like we said, you're supposed to kind of ingest all the information, it becomes part of you. So the idea of even the greatest scholars have to repeat the story every single year, even though they could tell it to you by heart, and they could tell you everything about it. It doesn't matter, because the more you discuss and experience the story, the more you feel it. And the idea is always to create the feelings and create the emotions, let it impact your, or how we relate to the world. That's the goal of the Seder night. And the more you discuss it, the better, because the more and more you discuss the story, the more messages you pull out, the more fundamental Judaism jump out at you, the more understanding of God that we have. And that's always our goal. You know, the old there's a metaphor given in a lot of the older commentaries, which nowadays is pretty much irrelevant, because all we do, if we want to bold something, we just push the bold on the computer and it's bold. But it used to be you take your quill, you go over the letters again and again and again if you want it to be bolder. So you're writing out something, you write T, you go over the T again and T again, then it gets bold. So it's called Havaras Akumlus. It's constantly making the quill go over the letter. And the point is that, because the more you discuss something, the more ingrained it becomes in yourself. So we've all been through this story many, many times, but the more we discuss it, repeat it, and think about it, it becomes deeper ingrained in the person, and more influential in the person's life. And that's our goal at the Seder. That's the first paragraph we'll discuss in the Haggadah. So God willing, next week, we'll continue with the Haggadah, and we'll try to go through some more points.